Hello, this is Bernadette Russell. Welcome to the Telleston House and Gardens Dreams podcast. Many of the pieces you will hear were written during my year's residency at Telleston House and Gardens, inspired by the house and gardens and by the dreams that we had whilst we were there. So sit back, relax, enjoy, and listen.
Dreaming in the House of Secrets by Sarah Ragg. On butterfly wings I saw with the hazy breeze, through white wafting net into a world travel bedroom with stars on the ceiling and lavender dreams on the walls. Forward I float through crescent moon into abandoned hall, half lit under leaves and cobwebbed chandelier. The muddied walls and antique mirrors reflect the times of riches lost and decades of sumptuously crafted indifference. I flap my wings through tartan walls to a crested room where angels weep in hellish dark. Salted by the sea and dragon scales, a white rabbit slowly plays a nightmare tune, making the ghostly child laugh as he hides the key. Pulled towards the gentle shush of waves, I glide outside, expecting rugged coast, but encounter instead an unexpected garden. Thistle and herbs surround an ancient stone, scored with a labyrinth that maps the path I am not taking. My fragile form slides down a honeyed sunbeam into a smoke-hung room where gentle violins serenade Pan's low-beamed mischief, silently mocked by the cold stares of long-gone creatures. Faster I go, down past the bookish mouse's home, rising high over voodoo shrine and oaken boats, then through an office of cedar words and whiskered intrigue, commanded by a tarot owl who pulls the surgeon's strings and forces him to dance with death. Ascending into oppressive eastern heat, I flutter past cotton prayers to make my peace with household gods, ere plunging into an orchid future. At last I dive into the lemongrass spring, where, in the gentle babble, I sputtering wake, finally aware of my secret within.
The Office of Dreams by Jules Abrams. There was once a world before dreams, a world where humans slept, embraced by the dark, nothing to illuminate their nights but a vacuum where their dreams should have been. All dreams had been taken, archived by a curiously ambivalent god in a back office attended by angels. The Office of Dreams. An office stacked with filing cabinets that towered to infinity, each numbered by category and type in digits that ran beyond a Googleplex. And the humans had no idea that their dreams were in deep storage until one escaped. It was a rebel angel, isn't it always, who took a box of unfiled surplus dreams home from work. Gabriella, for that was her name, put them in her spare room. It was a Luddite move, given her usual technological expertise. She should have known better than to keep dreams in cardboard boxes. Which meant that, afterwards, some said she did it deliberately. Perhaps she had planned to release the dreams back into the wild, shake things up a bit. Perhaps she had been disgruntled for quite some time, or perhaps she was envious of the wonderful and terrifying dreams she had filed. In her time on Earth, she had been a good human, she thought. She could not be sure, it was so long ago. Dreams were her speciality. She'd spent an infinity filing them in the office, had set up a system sensitive to touch ID from the merest flutter of an angel's wing, a system that took her time and toil to perfect, and for which she had had no reward. Constrained and overlooked for promotion, Gabriella plotted to start her own registry, removing one or two dreams at a time. Now, it just so happened that a mouse, a particular mouse from Taliston House, was on his astral travels the day Gabriella stacked her boxes in the spare room. Being a fastidious creature, you know how mice like to tidy, he took the ramshackle pile of boxes as a challenge and began to organise them, nibbling his way through the corner of the largest. As he gnawed and clawed, tapping his tiny paws into the files, a dream escaped, whirled past his tiny whiskers, and, before he had the chance to sneeze, squeezed through a fissure in time, landing in the mind of a middle-aged woman with mild insomnia. Gabriella opened her garage door and saw the mouse sitting on its haunches, a crumb of cardboard clinging to a whisker and a mouse-shaped hole in the box behind. "What have you done?" she thundered. The mouse trembled. He knew angels had a terrible temper. "I was just trying to help, to organise the dreams." Gabriella's voice shook the heavens. "That is the task of angels. That is my job, and no creature, flesh or spirit, will take it away from me." The room filled with cumulus cloud, thunder-grey smoke, fire and brimstone boiled, an explosion that singed the mouse's whiskers as she raged. "A missing dream will leave a gap on my map of dreams." She could not complete the transfer of dreams to her own registry with one so blatantly gone. She sank to the floor, wings folded. Her revolution was not going to plan. "Where is it?" The mouse squeaked, brave soul, before she tipped into another apocalyptic explosion. "Queen Charlotte, 1786, Essex." "How do you know that?" The mouse trembled to the end of his whiskers as he explained. "The house I live in is rippled with time fissures. I am an expert on them, your angelness. Let me go after the dream. The queen is restless. I am nimble. I am quick. I can catch it." Gabriella looked at the tiny creature. Her eyes were rimmed with sulphur. She was already weary of this complication. "How so, little mouse? The world of dreams is rough. You need to be bigger, stronger. It needs an angel." The mouse, timid, ventured more, drew himself to his full mouse height. "I am brave. Please let me try." Gabriella stood, her wings filling the room. "We will both go." In a time 225 years before the jealous angels collected human dreams, generations before Gabriella's systems streamlined the office of dreams, a time when dreams thrived, survived, if sleep could be found, the queen sighed. To sleep, perchance to dream, in the Georgian splendour of a bed made for a king, her husband, who would be consuming the last dregs of a gallon of port at the dinner table and whose gout would keep them up all night. She shifted onto her side, appreciating the effort of her hosts. They had covered the walls in watered silk of duck-egg blue, draped the window with curtains of ruby velvet and made the bed especially. The best bed in the world, lavished with embroidery from France, the mattress padded and heated with a copper warming pan. Yet still, she could not sleep. She knew it was stuffed with straw. Gabrielle hovered above, unseen. "I will make her sleep," she vowed, and drifted closer over the smell of sour milk and the waft from the chamber pot to whisper a lullaby into the queen's ear. The mouse darted, delighted, into the bed of straw. He burrowed deep, gained ground, reached out a paw as Gabriella reached out a wing. But the dream, cunning as it came, knew how it was hunted and saw the flicker of another rip in time. It slipped away to the time where it was first found, many hundred years hence. Gabriella raged again. "I told you you would have to be stronger. I will do it myself. I will be a bear, more powerful than you, better at catching a dream." She abandoned the mouse in the 18th century. He was not disappointed or insulted. He would be a mouse in the queen's bed, her royal sleep companion. It would do for now. Gabriella flew into the 21st, where a couple curled in a modest bed within their home on a gated drive where the grand house once stood. Another middle-aged woman with mild insomnia. Gabriella whispered a bedtime story into her ear, stirring the dream, making it lucid enough to be remembered, but so ridiculous no one would believe its retelling. The woman's head nodded. She slipped beneath the duvet and dreamt a dream in which she boarded a bus that rumbled on a dusty road. She climbed to the top deck and watched with detachment as a lumbering, drooling, snub-nosed bear, grisly and damn impatient, ran alongside. She looked out of the window to a landscape of litter-spattered hedgerows and sluggish canals, end-terrace streetscapes that opened into fields, and paths and hills, copses and broken trees rent by suburban vandalism. The edgelands of their estate, where boys swung from branches and girls perched like birds in the upper boughs. There were streams and footpaths, birdsong and echoes. She had a sudden urge to get outside and get away from that bear. Too late! There was a crash, smash, the bear was on, and he hadn't paid his bus fare. It's all right, the woman thought. It's a silly dream. Bears cannot climb narrow stairs to the top deck of a bus. She was wrong. It sat next to her on the warm vinyl seat, stinking of bear smell. Funny how she could smell it in a dream. It did not look like as if he was going to eat her. If anything, it looked more anxious than she did, but she made her excuses and slid past, rang the bell. Gabriella lumbered after the woman, who was enjoying the strange familiarity of box houses, hedges and lampposts. Everything was magnified in her dreamscape. Each leaf rustle a whisper of technicolour scents. She could feel the profusion of life beyond the buildings, the ladybirds on shiny leaves and sticklebacks in rolling streams. It lifted her soul. If it wasn't for the bear insistent in its pursuit, she would be having a lovely time. Gabriella sweated exasperation through her bare fur. She roared in frustration and the woman woke. As she did, Gabriella fluttered to the floor, her angel wings fatigued by the chase. But she had the dream, finally, clutched in a bare paw. She waited to see what would happen next. Would the woman remember? That could not be allowed. She followed the woman into the kitchen, watched her pick a piece of bacon from between two slices of bread and speak to her partner. The strangest thing happened last night. I dreamt. Gabriella's heart lodged in her mouth. Thunderous, they would hear her. She fluttered by, breath held as the woman recounted her dream. And then I woke up, she said. What do you think it means? Her partner shrugged, indifferent. Gabriella knew what it meant. She sighed, an angelic sigh, and wished she could taste the bacon. The archive had been breached, but there was no need to worry. The humans might as well have their dreams back. No one would believe them anyway.
Van Dore, and I am here with the Taliesin Writers Circle in the Star Room, which is a futuristic Japanese tea room. And it's evening time, it's a beautiful light, and I am going to read an extract from my novel, And Breathe. And it's an extract that I've modified especially for this podcast, so that hopefully it makes sense on its own. And I've called it Yoga Nidra, which is a kind of sleeping meditation. So Natalie took a deep breath. Okay, everyone, on your backs, hands by your sides. The woman wiggled into position. The idea is to bring you to samadhi, Natalie said, a state of consciousness where the mind becomes still. Taking long, audible breaths, she asked the woman to focus on their own breathing, following the rise and fall of the abdomen. I know it's hard with everything that's going on, but if you focus on the breath, it's a way to go inside yourself, where they can't reach you. Truly closed her eyes. Behind her eyelids, the world was red. What I usually say in class is, inhale relaxation into the body, exhale tension. It sounds, well, a bit trite to say it here, but it does sort of work, and it's the best thing I've got. Her voice caught. You're doing brilliantly, said Trulli. Starting with the fingers, Natalie directed awareness around the body. When she reached the toes, she began chanting. Om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum. Do you remember the last time we chanted this together? She asked softly. It was dark, but we were safe then, warm in front of that fire. Trulli thought of the night, their last breaths of freedom before a jeep full of boy soldiers rode into their yoga resort, interrupting them during downward dog. Can you feel the heat? Natalie asked. Trulli pictured the glowing yellow flames. Her breath quickened. Om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum. Natalie had given them three pieces of paper that night and asked them to write on each one something they'd like to let go of. She asked them to think about what they'd written. Trulli pictured herself sitting outside her lagoon villa and the pen she'd used. Later on the beach, Natalie made a bonfire and asked them to feed each paper to the flames. Trulli had enjoyed watching the first go up. It had felt like such a release. She'd almost laughed when the second one burnt, but the third one had escaped the fire, and despairing that she would never be free, Trulli had run into the ocean. Fear. She had written the same word three times. Even then she'd been afraid. She was still afraid of Julian now, even here in this hellhole. Her worst fear was of her husband finding her and what he'd do to her because she'd tried to escape. Om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum. Natalie let the chant fall through the air. If you started to have negative thoughts, she said, don't repress or deny them. This is your punishment. Julian leered into Trudy's mind. His presence seemed tangible. She could smell his aftershave, invictus. Natalie's soothing tone spoke over his. Accept the negativity, then dismiss it. Trulli invited Julian to step forward. His soul was brown while hers was blue. She watched as the two souls wound around each other, merging and splitting, then coming together again. That, after all, was how we made Felix. Julian bowed to her. She caught a glint in his eye that said he too was thinking of that time. And suddenly she forgave him. Her heart flooded with love for their son, and she realised that she loved the part of Julian that had given her Felix. I'm not afraid of you, she told him. His soul turned, a faint glimmer on the chest where once he had held her. At the start of their relationship, she'd found comfort there. Ever since, he'd tried to stifle her, but in so doing, he had killed the part of him that had once been able to make her smile. Julian's soul lifted its head from the dance. The light had gone out of his eyes, which were dark like sockets. Her soul shook its head. Waving with her hand, she told him to go. He twirled around, hesitating. She blew at him a short, sharp puff. Enough to make him spin away, she watched him rise up to the heavens like the piece of paper that hadn't burned.
Next is The Birds Are Calling by Sarah Boren.
Amari awoke to birdsong rich in the air. Powdered blue skies mounted bright yellow rapeseed fields as she opened the curtains. It's going to be a good day, she thought. She made her way across her bedroom and caught a glimpse of her face in the mirror. Her stomach lurched. A full rounded beak with a hooked tip dominated the centre of her face. It was a deep violet colour and glistened against the sunlight. She closed her eyes tight, praying for it to be a dream. She slowly opened her eyes. They weren't the beady black eyes of a bird. They were still almond-shaped, with irises the colour of speckled blue marbles. She still possessed the same upturned chin and fleshy pink cheeks, and even the fine lines on her forehead remained unchanged. She placed her hand over the beak, ready to touch it, and a dark feather fell from her head to the floor. Tentatively, she stroked her head. At first, it felt and looked like slick, wet hair, but as the feathers fanned out, they were soft and tickled her fingers. What's happening to me? Huge wings spanned at her side, sending an entire row of books and the lamp crashing from the shelf. Everything all right, love? Amaria's mum called to her. Everything's fine, mum, she replied breathlessly. She was relieved to hear the familiar sounds of her mum pottering around the kitchen again. Pots and pans were clinking together and the dull whir of the pipes was going as her mum washed up. Amaria plucked a feather from the wings and ran her fingers across it. The colour blended from black to deep purple to cobalt blue. In a way, she had never felt so beautiful, but in the most peculiar and terrifying way. We're going out now, Amaria's dad shouted up to her. We're back this evening. Have fun, Amaria called down to them a little too enthusiastically. The door slammed shut and Amaria exhaled deeply. How on earth am I going to explain this to them? But for now, all she wanted to do was fly. Amaria stood at the top of the barn, legs wobbling, and looked down at the bales of hay resting on the ground. She imagined herself missing them and landing on the concrete, blood dripping from her skin and wings sprawled at her side. Bile rose to the top of her throat, but at that moment her wings opened. A sign, she thought, a gentle encouragement to be brave. With some deep breaths, she coaxed the fears from her mind. She took large steps backwards and launched into a running jump over the edge. She began to plummet and started to scream shrilly. It felt like her heart was colliding with her ribcage. Her wings spread out at her side and thrusted her into the unknown. She was soaring higher and higher until the clouds clipped her wings and the sky ran its tongue along her skin and goosebumps pimpled her body. Birds swerved when they saw her, diving and bobbing at the sight of her large hybrid body. Nonetheless, joyful birdsong flowed from her beak. After a couple of laps of the field, she grew tired, dizzy with exhilaration, as she struggled to catch her breath. She was launching towards the ground, wings flapping frantically around her. Vivid green fields were edging closer, and bugs flew in chaos at her face. With metres to go, she tucked her legs to her chest, held her breath, and landed on her bum with a thud. A worm poked its plump head from the dirt. Amaria picked it up between her thumb and forefinger and placed it to her lips. It writhed about, struggling to get free. She gagged at the thought of it, but its earthy scent and the smooth texture of its skin against her lips gave her the urge to bite down on it, taste the juice of its flesh. Both the worm and the world felt magical, and all of her senses exploded like fireworks. All of a sudden, the clouds hung like plumes of smoke in the sky, and in the distance, branches were being snapped beneath boots. A raven fled across the sky, wings pummeling. A loud click was followed by a shot, and a shrill squawk pierced the air. The bird plummeted, and its feathers scattered across the sky. Raspy air escaped her beak, and she ran to the old oak tree and began to climb. Twigs cracked under her feet and fell to the ground. The men's voices were getting louder, their laughs more bitter. Amaria's foot slipped and she began to fall, but managed to catch the branch above her and pull herself up. The men were standing close by with guns pointing towards the tree. They were so silent, so still, but their energy screamed. They were taunting her, baiting her to fly. She knew this, but all she wanted to do was escape. That familiar click startled her and she was flying through the clouds. Bullets were aiming at her from all directions. She felt strangely light, wild and free, and when she looked down at her body, everything had changed. She was a bird, pure and unhindered, without limp arms and legs to stunt her flight. She was nearly out of sight, but just as she tasted relief, a bullet rippled through her small feathered body. Her beak prized open, every bit of her body tense, and she fell from the sky like a penny. She landed on the floor as a hybrid, wings bent and broken, awkward limbs tangled together. She cupped the wound on the side of her torso, and blood seeped through the joints of her fingers. "What the hell is that?" a shaky voice called. He took a step closer and jarred back at the sight of Amaria. "Shoot it," the other man demanded. Amaria opened her eyes and saw her father. He saw a monster. His gun was poised at her chest. "Dad, it's me. Don't shoot," Amaria pled. But he had already launched the bullet, and the most beautiful day of Amaria's life ended. The birdsong was no more. Amaria jolted upright in her bed, shivering and covered in sweat. She switched on her bedside lamp and ran her hand down her face. Relief hit her as she felt the squidgy cartridge of her nose. There was a knock on the door and her dad entered. His face was pale and he was still in his overalls and wellies and was traipsing mud across the carpet. He sat on her bed, wrapped his arms around her and kissed her forehead. "Is everything okay, Dad?" "I had a terrible nightmare last night," he said, wrinkles etched on his forehead. "I did too," Amaria replied. "What was yours about?" He said, "I shot you." There was a trembling tear balancing in the corner of his eye. Amaria looked at him and fought back the lump in her throat. "I know." A lone feather fell from the ceiling and landed in between them both. Her father stumbled backwards and landed on the floor, gasping for air. "It can't be," Amaria shuddered, clambering out of bed. And in the most chaotic case of reality, the bed cover fell to the floor and the sheets were covered in torn, bloodstained feathers.
Hello, I'm Mark Boucher, and I'm going to read a short section from my fantasy novel, The Boy Who Stole Time. Now, The Boy Who Stole Time is the story of a young boy named Krish. Now, Krish's mum is dying, and Krish obviously wants to try and save her life, and he meets this strange devil-like creature, and this creature says that time is this real substance called Mithali, and that he can go out and find it in these other magical kingdoms. And at this point, Krish has travelled to the land of Alea and has met a young girl wizard called Balthrea, who is helping him on this quest to try and get the Mithali. He's been set three impossible challenges by a king who has said if he can complete them, he can get the Mithali. He's obviously mocking him, but now Krish is actually trying to get it, and we join the story just as Krish begins to realise that himself and Balthrea are being pursued by some strange creatures. "Get some sleep," Balthrea spoke in a voice which was almost irritated by its own calmness. Krish couldn't deny that he was desperate for sleep. But every time he felt himself nodding off, those dogs were there, just on the edge of the woods, lost, sniffing the ground, the trees, the plants, anything. They were trying to pick up the scent, their scent, he knew it. Sleep. Balthrea's staff made gentle circles in the air. Krish began to slip away from the conscious world. In an instant, a dream swooped in and took him. A snort, a muzzle lifts out of the dirt, looking ahead into the trees, eyes wide, an ecstasy of barking, lean muscular legs pounding through darkened woods. Screaming, he was screaming in the dark. Their paws beat the ground, they were close, too close. Screaming, she calls out, she calls again. He doesn't understand her words. So close, smell of putrid meat on their breath. Her desperate whispers. Where? Which direction? He points. Their pace was quickening. Their quarry was near. The twine thrust into his hands, the mule neighing, running from them, her tearing the dead creature on the ground, scattering the flesh behind them as they run. Some chewed the meat, others barked. This was not their prey. Running, running, hearts beating wild in their chests. Violent breaths, stumbling over branches, feet too close, confused. Fingers, his fingers large as swollen branches. They were on their scent again. The swish of a blade, a shriek of pain across his arm, his friend opening his vein. A faint attempt at reassurance through stuttering breaths. Her mixing his blood with the meat, discarded on the ground. Beasts tearing into bloody flesh, swallowing leaves and twigs and dirt stuck to that filthy mess. Wading, rancid stagnant water, her commanding him to drench himself. Her hand on his wound. The scent was cold. They had had their fill. For now. Water so close, too close, feeling it at his waist, seeing it up to his neck. He would drown. He was lost. He'd die, falling under the water. One eye above, both below. No sense. What? What? Help. Deep, deep below. Drowning. Dying. Fetid water pouring down his throat. Her over him, shouting, shouting, screaming. No sense. Every mark, every scratch, every bead of sweat on her skin so clear. Open your eyes! He swore she was calling out to him in his dream and in the real world all at once. Krish, open your eyes. Open your... He jolted awake. Eyes! He was lying in a shallow pond no higher than his knees. Balthrae still hovered over him, but she was a little further away than she had been in his nightmare. Where are they? She asked. He looked into her eyes, confused, and she asked again. Don't know, he said. Look. He looked roughly in the direction of where the dogs had been chewing the meat in his dream, but he saw nothing. Look, she said, just for a moment. Then he realized. The smoke in his eyes. The grains of sand. The wind. That's when he'd seen them. Hesitantly, he allowed his eyelids to slide over his eyes. Across the forest, a clearing, dogs stood over the carcass. One's head shot a look in his direction, snarling. Krish opened his eyes with a gasp. Balthrae was looking expectantly at him. There, he said. Over there. One looked. It's fine. The water will keep you off their scent for now. At least, well, it should do. We'd better move on. Keep your eyes open. Krish looked into her eyes, which were fearful, apologetic. They're real, aren't they?
Bernadette Russell. Bev's eyes blink heavily. They are sticky with flu. Her bones jangle, a meaty glockenspiel playing a sickly melody of discordant notes, her brain bashing the side of her skull every time she dares to move her head. It happens every year of late. She's felled by the season's change. When the earth smells of sweet rot and the forest is dressed for evening in amber, russet, gold, the colours of wealth. She coughs into her palm and sees it sprinkled with scarlet. Bev's well used to sweating out sickness, but she's older now. There's no one coming to rescue her, she knows that for sure. She isn't Snow White and this isn't Disney. She thinks, if I don't rally, I'll die of thirst or hunger. Then the foxes will start to nibble at the edges of me, and soon all that will be left are tea-coloured bones and my few remaining teeth. And this thought makes her smile. She enjoys the thought of disappearing completely, unremembered, to become one of the many secrets of this ancient forest. She wipes the blood from her palm on the moss beneath her, thinks no more of it. At school, Bev listened to the girls talking, and she didn't know how to join in.
She couldn't think of questions or comments, not a single thing. She found the boys easier as they did stuff rather than spoke. She watched them playing football, and when the ball wandered in her direction, she would hoof it back into play and the boys would shout, "Cheers, Bev," and carry on. But she never joined in the games properly, nor was she invited to. Her schoolmates weren't often cruel to her. They mostly ignored her, and this was a blessed relief. She found animals even easier than boys. She wasn't allowed pets, but hung around the park to meet other people's dogs. As a child, she'd lived with her granddad. Her mum and dad had long since scarpered, daunted and depressed by the drudgery of caring for a newborn baby. They went back on the road, making their living playing mournful songs in holiday towns all over Europe. Her gramps had a recording of them and he played it for her over and over, plus showed her the one photo of them, her dad on a child-sized accordion with a belt for a strap, her mum on a fiddle, both all sharp bones in shapeless, muddy-coloured clothes. On the CD she heard them both sing in beautiful harmony, such aching beauty in their voices, though they'd never sung for her, not even at bedtime, not once. They sent money, though, in varied currencies. Her granddad taught her practical things, including how to start a fire, grow runner beans, dress a wound. When she found him, slumped him in his armchair one Sunday afternoon, tongue lolling out, tea spilled, broken teacup, face all grey and yellow, she waited for 2 whole days until she admitted to herself he was dead. Then she grabbed the bundle of banknotes Granddad kept for emergencies in an old sewing box, filled a rucksack with blankets, food and tea bags, and she took off through the ragged gap in their garden fence into the forest. She went further till she couldn't hear the sound of traffic. She built a shelter like Granddad showed her, lit a fire. She lay on her back and watched the sun travel through the leaves. She sang her mum and dad's songs to herself until she slept. In the night, badgers came, and foxes and owls, but she did not wait until daybreak. Later that first day, the old man came. She hardly saw him till he was right beside her. His decrepitude was a reflective camouflage in the undergrowth. Without preamble, he showed her where he lived, on a mattress made of layers of porno mags and ancient doormats. He sat on an old car seat and told her what to look out for. His voice sounded scratchy like an old LP, and so quiet she had to lean in until she could see the pores of his skin and smell him. He smelled of green, she thought, nicer than she'd expected him to. He warned her about mountain bikers. "They fly by, they knock you off your feet. Day trippers. It can be quite funny to scare them a bit, but remember, scared people are dangerous. And criminals. Don't look, don't ask, stay away." And then he fell into silence and seemed to forget she was there at all. She saw him 3 days in a row, though he never said another word to her. On the third day, he gave her a clutch of quail eggs and she never saw him again. She was never entirely convinced that she hadn't made him up. Bev made herself invisible in the forest. She could not risk being seen. She was pretty sure it was not allowed to make home here, to not pay rent, to light fires. They would say she was weird, like at school when they pulled faces behind her back, and the teacher told her she needed to make more of an effort to join in. She remembered her granddad telling her stories of women who got put in the madhouse for offences such as living by themselves, not cutting their hair, or not tidying their kitchen. Soon Bev's hair would lay in muddy ropes down her back and her clothes turn into a tangle of stinking rags. She wasn't mad, she knew that. But they might say she was. She wasn't afraid either. She got used to the intense dark at night time. It's a long time since there's been anything to fear in an English forest. No bears or wolves or lions here. Of course there were people to be scared of, but she hid carefully from them. And it was as much as the old man had warned her. She saw East End gangs settling scores, men digging shallow graves into which they tipped bin liners filled with secrets and guns and bodies, lovers with nowhere else to go. She put the frighteners on the occasional human predator that followed lone children by just appearing and growling low from her belly, starting suburban legends throughout the county of Essex. She had felt a bit lonely after the first couple of weeks. Her last trip outside the forest had been to Club Row Market off Brick Lane. Her granddad had taken her there many times to see the cages of larks, thrushes, canaries and pigeons. On her 4th birthday, he'd introduced her to Ralph, who'd entered folklore, local lore, when he bought a lion cub off a ship in the docks 40 years ago and sold it at the market. "Good company, animals," her granddad had said. "They don't judge and they never tell tales. little Bev nodded, solemn. Bev hung around the market until the end of the day. She bought cup after cup of steaming tea and watched people talking and laughing. At 5 o'clock, she spent the last of Grandad's money on a bamboo cage of parakeets. Back in the forest, she set them free. They survived, thrived, filled the trees. She never left the forest again. Years passed. Bev had missed mobile phones, the internet, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, revolutions and changes of government, royal weddings and deaths. She wasn't sure how old she was, maybe 60, maybe 70 by now. She began to find it hard to tell when she was awake or asleep. One day a pale lady on horseback told her she was chosen, that her kind were as old as the forest itself. The lady told her she was a kind of goddess. She thought that unlikely, a goddess called Beverly Furlong. But she took the responsibility seriously. She bore witness, silently. She let a girl die once. The girl cut open her wrist with a pocket knife and a small smile. Bev knew she meant business. She bled out next to the stream in dappled sunlight so quietly. Then the police came with sirens and tape that looked like wasps. Bev's life was full of sunrises and sunsets of heartbreaking beauty. Winter mornings when she woke half buried in soft snow, she saw her parakeets flourish and form emerald flocks. Years passed when she spoke to no one. She lost track of time. One midwinter night she saw a hunting party full of people she knew. Her teacher at school, her mum and dad, her granddad, all racing past in scarlet jackets and breeks, their horses snorting smoke, chasing some invisible quarry. Once they'd passed, into the clearing came a perfectly white stag. He looked at her and she fell into his eyes. When she woke, she knew she was dying. Her voice like a rusty tin now, she said to her birds, "Go find someone to take my place." She knew that there were things that made a forest, and one was a lone soul such as C, the witness who doesn't speak. Curtis lived secretly in the park. Back in his care home, he'd stood silently and listened to the kids talking and couldn't think of what to say. So he left to get away from the noise. He gave up waiting for his mum to come back. He ran away with £25 in his back pocket and 2 changes of clothes. In the park, he found a tiny brown bird fallen on the path. In his palm, he felt its little heart beating so fast, he didn't know how to help. Then he saw a flock of emerald birds. Even with his headphones on, he heard them calling, "Follow me, follow me." Curtis kicked over the remains of his fire and left, his hand curled carefully over the broken bird. The moment Curtis and Bev met in the forest, they just stared at each other, holding their breath. The parakeets settled in the branches around the old woman and the beautiful boy. Curtis showed Bev the broken bird he'd cradled in his palm. He didn't know what to do with it. The first thing she taught him was how to preserve a life. And he'd never shown this side of himself to anyone before this. His tenderness had been private. But Bev was like no one. She was like a dream. Bev tells him she'll teach him everything he needs to survive. That night they ate a stew, and they sat in comfortable silence next to the spitting fire. The stars seemed so close, as if you could reach out and touch them like low-hanging fruit. Bev said she'd last just long enough to teach him what he needed. The birds would stay with him. He'd live in the forest now. Bev said, "You'll be safe here, Curtis, I promise." Eventually they fell asleep. In the night, badgers came, and foxes and owls. They did not wake until daybreak.
Next is The Dreamer of Ants by John Tarrow.
The dreamer of ants whispers and the night walkers enter. The house opens, unfolds, enfolds. Doors close and our dream eyes open. The only way out is in. There is no time, trace, place, so we must go deeper, even deeper, ever deeper. In the boy's haunted room, there's a blindfolded girl reading from a book of dreams. She kneels in the dark in so many ways, while oceans crash against her skirted cliffs, and we stand breathless, deathless. In a Moorish castle on stilts at the crossroads of all worlds, strings pluck the paths of the dreamer's dreams. We hear, fear, feel and see everything, yet remember nothing. There is no time, trace, place, so we must go deeper, ever deeper, onward, sleeper. Upon our knees in a Shinto temple, wind whistles enchantments through us, while red ribbons and bows tie us to ourselves and all our dark reflections. As above, at the office window, trumpets play a serenade to those who scramble. As below, in the cold of a leafless Irish garden, in a cabin in the woods, voices creak their messages, a discordant wilderness brought from the mouth of the Canadian wilds. There is no time, trace, place, so we must go deeper, ever deeper, O nightmare keeper. The red man floats in a sea of memory, with an origami bird pecking at his chest. Because time is different here, so different, so here. The dreamer of ants whispers, and the night wakers remember.